This meeting is now being recorded.
So please kindly take your seats. We're going to start. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the open part of the BTC meeting. I will have a roll call, but normally, and I will explain, and we will talk about that in the AOB, how we organize these meetings. BTC is quite new, so there is not much tradition here, but we decided to have these open meetings, and when we decided that, the original idea was to basically have them open to observers. So we continue our deliberations, but others can observe, either remotely or physically. This is still the case, and for that reason, for the roll call, I would like to ask only BTC members and the ICANN staff who support BTC, please introduce themselves. We are going to propose a change to that model. We had a very nice suggestion from Octo to basically mix the tech open meetings, technical expert group open meetings, with a BTC. And I would like to discuss that in the last 10 minutes of this meeting to see how that goes. So with that, may I ask BTC members and org staff supporting BTC introduce themselves? Afri?
Afri Doria.
Susanna Bennett, ICANN Org.
Becky Burr.
Jonas Hoininen.
George Sadowski.
Dan Halloran, ICANN Org.
Matthew Shears.
Lito Ibarra.
Kaveh Rangver.
David Conrad, ICANN Org.
Lisa Salino, ICANN Org.
Wendy Prophet, ICANN Org.
Kathy Peterson, ICANN Org.
Matt Larson, ICANN Org.
John Crane, ICANN Org.
Adiela Plogan, ICANN Org.
Alain Durand, ICANN Org.
Ram Mohan.
Rhonda Sutton.
Martin Butterman.
Thank you very much. And we have a few observers online, and we have a few physically in the room. Thank you very much for joining us. With that, I will ask John to please kindly take the floor and start.
Thank you, Kaveh. So I've been asked to give an update on the domain abuse activity reporting tool. So I will go ahead and do that. Let me just take control over here. Here we go. So I think most of you have seen some of this before and have been updated, but I want to run it through it quickly, and I want to talk a little bit about where our status is. So DAR, as we call it, or the Domain Abuse Reporting System, is a system for reporting domain name, registration, and abuse data across TLDs and hopefully in the future registrars. It studies all the generic top-level domains. We have something like 2,000 registries in there, and I can give you the exact numbers in a little bit later at the end of the slides. We employ what are called reputation block lists or reputation feeds. It's a lot of data, and it's hopefully going to accommodate some historical studies. We've got about a year's worth of data now. We can look back and see things that have happened in the past. We're looking at the multiple threats or DNS abuse of phishing, botnets, malware, and spam. And we're trying to take a scientific approach, and importantly is that we are trying to be very transparent about what we're doing. So we're not only talking to the board committees, we're also talking to the community and some of the technical community and security communities out there. And we're trying to do something that others can reproduce. So, you know, the idea is that we will publish our methodology, we will publish where our data feeds are from, and others, if they so wish, can go and do the same kind of work. One of the other initiatives that we have in the Office of the CTO is the Open Data Initiative, and one of the goals of this initiative that we're doing of DAR is that we want to actually push the derivative data out into ODI so that people can download it in the same way they can other ICANN data, once again aiming for that transparency. The data we use comes from various sources. Some of those are public, some are very what we describe as open, and some of them are actually commercial sources that we pay for. Specifically, the reputation block lists have costs associated with them. We also use Whois data and zone file data. So the idea is that we would bring these data together and we would curate it. Go ahead.
Sorry, do you prefer questions after the presentation?
It's completely up to you. You're the chair. So.
Okay, so if possible, I think interruptions are better. I have a question from Ron. Ron?
Thanks for letting me interrupt. Back on the Whois data on the last slide, I mean, I guess there's probably access to Whois information internally, but there's this other big thing that we're talking about this week about hiding all the Whois and different models about what that hiddenness might look like. How does it impact this ability to collect and analyze?
So because we're looking at reproducibility, we're not using any data, or I should say we're not using any privilege that ICANN might have to access data. So we're trying to do things publicly in the way that any other researcher could. And accessing Whois data is actually very problematic. We are looking at somewhere in the region of 186 million different labels, different names. And to keep all of our data up to date, we need to query the Whois. We're only interested in one very specific or two specific labels from the Whois data. One is obviously the label itself, the name, and the other is the IANA ID for the registrar. So we're only using Whois to identify who the registrar is associated with the name. We're not looking at any of the other data. Now, unfortunately, Whois doesn't let you query in that manner. And there is no other sort of out-of-band mechanism that I'm aware of for getting those IDs associated with names. And that is an interesting problem from a research standpoint. If you only want a specific piece of data and it's arguably, you know, it's not PII, there's no real way of getting it at the moment. So that's a struggle. Obviously, doing 185 or 186 million Whois queries a day is not really viable. So we're struggling with that. I don't know how GDPR will affect this because we don't know what Whois is going to look like after that. Hopefully, because the data we have isn't the identifiable data, we could still pull that from Whois. I wish there was another way of pulling it that didn't require millions of Whois queries. So does that answer the question? Okay. So the idea is once you've got this data, you can, you know, we can store it over time, and that gives us a historical view that we've not traditionally had into this abuse data. And one of the ideas is that we can actually work with operators and talk to them about this data and hopefully help them understand their operations. I've actually had the privilege of sitting with a couple of operators who've been interested and comparing data and saying, you know, this is what this shows, you know, related to your TLD. Do you see similar things? And it's actually interesting that they generally do. There's not much of that going on, but it's something we've started doing. It's a very good tool for reaching out and working with the operators and hopefully learning together. And basically studying the malicious registration behaviors that lots of other people are doing, but this gives us our own insight into the data. I keep pushing the button thinking I'm running a PowerPoint on my machine. So we have all the GTLD zones. We get the zone files from the centralized zone data system, just like everybody else can. That itself has also been interesting. So one of the things we're doing with this program is sort of, as the saying goes, eating your own dog food. So pulling all the zone files on a daily basis. We're only using the names that are appearing in the zone. So we're not talking about registered names. We're talking about resolving names. The thought there is that that is more relevant as something being a threat. Arguably, if you can't resolve it, you can't really do much with it. The numbers are a little bit higher than this at this moment. This I took this last week, this 1240 roughly GTLDs. So it's a lot of data. Today it was 186 million labels. This fluctuates as things go in and out of the zones. So as I just said, we use the published Whois data, and we're really only interested in who the registrar is associated with the name. So I just talked about this very problem. And if you can't get all of this data on a regular basis, it makes it really hard to have good, reliable data relating to which name is it which registrar at any particular time. So this is something we're struggling with. We're still struggling with associating registrars. So if anybody has bright ideas about how we could better do that name association, that would be really helpful. As it says in the slide, it's quite a challenge. So we take multiple block lists, but we count unique abuse domains. So if a name appears on more than one list, we only count it as one abuse name, but we do keep a record of which lists it's on. So we can go in and look at a name and say, well, you know, this name's on four or five different lists, but we will only count it once. We use quite a few lists, and I'll show you the actual list of those lists that we have. We're looking at phishing, malware, botnets, command and control, and spam, doing total and cumulative basis, providing pretty graphs that we can look at. Hopefully, at some point, once we've gone through all our technical reviews and methodology reviews, we'll be able to publish some of those. And we create histograms, charts. Anybody who's used to monitoring networks or data has seen many of these types of charts. There's nothing particularly different about what we're doing there, pie charts and graphs, etc. The important thing here is because we're looking at RBLs that are pretty prevalently used in security devices, we see this as looking at the way the security communities actually see the ecosystem. We call it an abuse reporting system, but arguably it's a reputation reporting system, because what it's really, in my opinion, demonstrating is the reputation of these TLDs with the security vendors and the block list that they use. So an important thing is we do not in any way, shape, or form compose our own block lists. That's not our expertise. Like I said, we actually source these from outside. It's a composite of the various feeds that we get. And as I said earlier, this is the same data that internet providers and businesses and security practitioners are using on a daily basis. So when we're looking at the reputation feeds, there are certain criteria that we had to put to them. Now, we've identified the four threats that we're looking at. So, you know, there are lots of reputation feeds out there that don't categorize in that manner. So we're not using those. We're not doing the categorization. It's actually the feeds themselves already come with these categories. There are feeds that focus on botnet command and control. There are feeds that focus on phishing, on malware, etc. Some of these very well known. We look to see whether people are recommending that these be configured in their security of devices. Most of the major hardware providers that provide firewalls, etc., you know, your Ciscos, your Junipers, and other people, they will actually have manual pages and forums where they recommend which lists you use. So we find these lists in there, and it's interesting to see that they tend to stick to a similar set of lists. Read a lot of academic literature to look to see who was being quoted and who was being pointed to as sources of threat data by the academia. And these are all threat lists that are well known and broadly accepted across the security community. So block lists are now everywhere. If you look at how networks are run and how they are secured, how people protect their end users, block lists is one of those technologies or one of those operational procedures that are very commonly used. Google Safe Browsing, Chrome, they used the APWG lists, and that's one of the lists we use. Akamai, the content delivery networks, AWS, all these cloud services, they're all using block lists. Your social media tools, Facebook has something called Threat Exchange, the Threat Exchange platform, where they share this kind of data in block list formats. And even in the DNS these days, people block at the DNS level using these lists. I already talked about commercial firewalls. There's just a list here of a few and what they're using. This is from our research. Obviously, anti-spam in mail uses these lists, and a lot of third-party email service providers use these lists too. Pretty much, if you're connecting to the internet, you're probably somewhere in your ecosystem using a block list. This is just a list of various articles that are out there. There's actually a lot of articles out there about how block lists are used and or use block lists for their data, for actually writing academia articles on threats and abuse in the system. Often, they're not really focusing on DNS because they're focusing on the URLs or, the websites, etc., but it's the same list that they're using. So this is the reputation set that we're using today. We can change this. Obviously, if we were to make a change to the list, we'd have to take a notation of that because it would affect the data. So we'd at least need to put some kind of flag in of when we made the change. And I'll leave that up for a second, and obviously people can download the slides so they can keep this for themselves. If you operate in the security realm or you run networks, you've probably heard of some of these. The reputation of the reputation lists, I'd say, differs from who you talk to. Some of these may have some false positives in. We think they're fairly low. But as I said, this is the reputation that people are using of these TLDs. There may be some false positives in there, but it doesn't actually change the reputational issue. You had a question?
So how do you envision access to the DAR when it's available for access? Because general stats, I understand, like, for example, we say, okay, .com, there are this many domains which are in lists, blah, blah. But if you provide access on domain level, then basically you are one of those composite lists. You're not that different from Malware Patrol or similar ones.
So this was not designed to give it as an operational tool to end users. So And the licensing agreements we have does not allow us, for example, to pass through a live feed, an RBL. And, you know, that's very explicit in some of these licensing agreements. So the derivative data, which is the term they use, our intention is to push that into ODI. That will be, for example, the number of labels in a TLD, the number of registered abuse names by type. That will be the kind of data that will be in there. I don't foresee it going much deeper than that, mainly for licensing agreements. Now, what we're doing is we're publishing the methodology and who we're using so that if others do want to do this, they can. We've done some work on trying to figure out whether or not you can do this at a lower cost, i.e. with only free lists. It's like anything in the world, you get what you pay for. So if you only use free data, it's not going to be as good as some of the more highly curated paid-for feeds. So to answer your question, in short, we're not planning to give direct access to this data. So we don't pretend it catches all abuse. You know, people have asked us this, so are you seeing everything? No. There was a lot of feeds that we didn't include. Either we weren't, you know, they weren't getting listed by academia, they weren't being used, and they're not being recommended by the security providers. Therefore, we didn't include them, or they didn't have the right threat categorization. So no, it's not all the data. I believe personally that we have a good set of the data. By trying to focus on making sure that the data quality was good, we've limited ourselves in the amount of data, but I personally think that was a good choice. So sometimes people say, well, why spam? And there's an argument to be made that spam is a kind of indicator. Also, the Government Advisory Committee have talked about this in the past. They were very specific about the other three threats. Now, we can actually do statistics quite simply just by using flags, and we look at things such as, you know, let's just look at the malware, let's just look at the botnet command and control. And if I talk directly to operators about the data that I'm seeing around those, that's actually the interesting thing, is to start breaking it down and saying, well, what are you seeing? For example, the botnet data in there, the command and control data for botnets is very much driven by what's happening in the takedown world. Right? So when you take down a piece of botnet infrastructure, the names may get registered and sinkholed to public safety or law enforcement name servers. And therefore, they may appear in these lists. Some of these lists actually recognize those and remove them, and some of them don't. But it's still an interesting thing to measure of where these command and control names are being placed. And as I said, you know, spam is seen as a delivery mechanism for many other threats. An important thing about how we measure the spam is that we're actually only looking at the names that are in the body of the spam message. So if you like, the target names, the names that are they're hoping to deliver the victims to, not the names in the headers. Right? It's a nuance, but it's an important nuance. So we've got lots of different ways of visualizing it, and we're working closely with Alain Donand from the ITHI, who's only today I saw some new statistics from him that are really interesting. This data's actually going back to September, and I'll update this for the next time we do this. We are now automatically gathering this data into reports on a monthly basis. We were doing it by hand at this point. So what you're seeing here is 5 months' worth of data across the four threats and differentiating between what we call a new TLD and a legacy. And the cutoff point there is the last round. So if your .info, for example, would be in the legacy, the new ones would be on the other side. You can see that most of the abuse space is in the spam. And then botnet CNC, malware, and new TLDs are less so, but it's there. It's not insignificant. Now, we don't know if these are going to work. No, unfortunately, our graphics aren't working. What you would see here normally is a bouncing red ball, which is a phishing campaign popping in and that popping up and then being taken down. So you suddenly see a little red dot of names from a phishing campaign that appear 1 month and then are gone the next, and they actually normally go down in about 2 days. And you can see similar things for botnet command and control. What we see in the data here is, for example, the Avalanche takedown was visible in this. We could see the dot going up and coming in and going out, which was interesting. And then spam is just all over the place. There's a lot of spam, but you can actually identify spam campaigns. Now, unfortunately, of course, this is historical. It would be awesome if we could predict them in the future, but we can actually go back and look at things in the past. So another interesting piece of data that we got asked was...
I have a question from Ram. The previous slide, what's the x-axis?
So that's the percent of abuse names, of spam names in the TLD. So there was somebody there at one point that had 80% of their names were listed on spam lists.
Sorry, the x-axis.
Oh, sorry, the x-axis. That is the size of the zone.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yeah. And that, when you download the slides, you can actually see the graphics and the bouncing balls, which is what it's all about. And thanks to Alan for actually doing the fancy graphics. So when you look at the percent of resolving domains in TLDs that have one or more name on an abuse list, because not everybody does. There are many TLDs that have absolutely no names on the abuse lists. Often they only have one name in because they're not actually selling names yet. This is what you see. It's, as you'd expect, most of the names resolving are still in the legacy space. When you look at the abuse, you see it evens out a bit more. So even though the legacy space is larger, from a percentual basis of the abuse names, the new space is catching up. And the numbers are still around this. It seems to have hovered around the 40%, which is interesting.
When you say legacy CCs are also part of that?
Or? No, there are no CCTLDs in here.
Yeah.
Now, we didn't do that because we didn't have access to zone files. Right. And also, we have no contractual relationship with them. They're not directly driven by ICANN policy, and this is really a data for policy tool. Many of them are now asking to be included, and we're trying to figure out how we do that, which was a nice surprise. So if you look at the most exploited TLDs, because we're not assuming these are necessarily abusers, they're more likely abused, what you'll find is that there's actually a very small percent of the TLDs where the abuse occurs. But when you look at the top 25 out of close to 2,000, now you're seeing that you're capturing 97% of the abuse. We're seeing that particular registries are being targeted. And who is being targeted does change over time, but in general, you see specific ones being targeted. And we're trying to look at if we can include things like pricing data and things like that in the future to figure out if it's associated with pricing. I think Ram.
John, so would that, is it then possible for somebody to look at these tables and say that in September of 2017, 67% of all new TLDs were exploited? Would that be an accurate conclusion to draw?
Which one we're looking at? In September,
67% of all new TLDs were exploited. What would a reporter write when they see that bottom right?
Now, this is 67% of names in a very, very small percentage of TLDs. It's 25 TLDs. So 25 TLDs have 67% of the resolving names, but 95% of the abuse data, the abusive names. So what this is telling me is that 95% of the abuse is in 25 of the new TLDs.
And the 67% means that 33% of the abuse is happening in legacy TLDs. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe so. I need to think about this. Dave put this slide together, so I will triple-check that. And in actual fact, I'll update it with new data, and I'll get that to the committee if you'd like that, Kaveh. Would you like an updated set of this data and a better explanation?
Yes, we are going to post this slide, and I think it's good if we have an updated one.
Yeah, for the we can do that.
Thank you.
So the project status, doing it right is more important than doing it fast. So this has taken us a long time. We're being very careful with what we say and what data we show. For example, we're not sure on our registrar data because of the WHOIS issue, so we're not publishing anything at the moment. We are currently reviewing the methodology. We've contracted two outside experts, well-known security experts, to do independent reviews. We are about to get the first one back. We saw a early copy, and some of the terminology was a little off because these are not DNS experts, so we were helping them with only with the terminology. And when we get the report, the first thing we're going to do is publish it, and then we'll go read it. Because they're supposed to be independent and we want to be transparent. So the first one I'm hoping we'll see maybe during this meeting. I don't know if I'll be able to get resources to publish it during the meeting. People are kind of busy. But as soon as we get a chance, we'll actually publish that. We'll review it. And if we need to make changes to the system, we shall do that. We've automated a lot of the reporting. Those graphs that we had here, we can now actually pull those much faster. Because we actually produce reports every month with those statistics. So hopefully it'll only take me 10 minutes to get you the new data. And that was it, really. I think David wants to.
Yeah, well, actually, it's good that there are a number of ESSAC people here, because one of the ideas we had is that when we get the reviews back from the reviewers, we would ask, or the board, or somehow, someone would ask ESSAC to provide an analysis as well, just so that we have the advisory committees who are responsible for security and stability to provide their input on this. So that's something that we would like to probably tee up. I'm not sure exactly the right protocol by which that would be done, but it's just something that we think ESSAC could provide some value.
Okay, thank you. This is George. I sympathize with your difficulty in getting registrar information using just the WHOIS tool. Had you considered doing a sample survey with all the attendant sample survey errors that are possible, say of 10% or something like that, to get a handle on what the problem might be?
I think we spent a lot of time trying to get all the data, and so we are sampling at the moment, because that's all we can do. I'd rather change the way we publish that data, but that's a whole different discussion. I know. I think these days everything should go in the DNS, right? Isn't that what they say, Yona? Everything in the DNS. But you know, Whois is just clunky for this. One of the things we really wanted to do was learn what pains other research people were going through, and now we feel it. It hurts.
Thank you. Ram?
Just to follow up to David. David, you were saying that there's an intent to have the methodology, the DAR project methodology, go to the SSAC for review. Is there a sense of timeline on that?
Well, not necessarily an intent, an interest. John said, you know, we want to do it right as opposed to do it quick, one of the thoughts that Joran had was that, you know, once we do these independent reviews, to provide that as input into ESSAC for their discussion. I mentioned this to Rod. Maybe Abu Dhabi or something like that. The reviews are, one is like, it, as John said, it should be done during this meeting. The second one fairly soon after that, so it would be relatively near term, like within a month at the outside. And whether or not we actually do this, you know, it's not set in concrete. It's just something that we thought would be useful both for ESSAC to provide input on the methodology, but also for the community and their assurance that, you know, we've taken all the appropriate steps, because it maybe look a little odd if, you know, we didn't run this by ESSAC for their input.
Thanks. Thanks for saying that you'd already mentioned it to Rod. Do you want me to convey that to the ESSAC, or is it, should I take it that it's already been conveyed to the ESSAC?
Right. That's why I said I don't really know what the protocol here is.
I mean, the typical thing is that the board asks the ESSAC to do work via the liaison. So I'm just trying to make sure that I understand what the intent is, and then we can go, you know, how we execute on the intent is fairly straightforward.
So what I'd recommend is that we wait a couple of weeks until we get the reviews in, and then maybe do a phone call to figure that out, the mechanics of it. I mean, these reviews may come back and say, God, this is all awesome, and they may not. so let's wait till we get the reviews in, and then let's have a phone call to just make sure we get the mechanics right.
Got it. Thanks. One other suggestion is that you might want to consider asking the GTLD registry stakeholder group and potentially the CC TLD registries to also take a look at the methodology. They're interested parties.
Yeah, I think the idea is to publish everything, and I don't think we'd really thought about the feedback mechanisms as much as we need to, because, you know, I think the PSWG is going to have some interest. I think the registrars are, you know, I think the whole community is going to be interested in this, and they should have their chance to help us with this.
Thank you very much. One question, which maybe I didn't get it, but have you planned or have you envisioned the access to the system? So is it going to be an open access, for example, or?
Yes and no. We don't think it's, like I said, we're going to push data into ODI, and that will be the main feature of access. That will be the mechanism to access to the, if we can publish the data, which is a licensing issue, then ODI will be our favored mechanism.
Because I see this as a very powerful supporting mechanism for policymakers, basically to have access to data. But if they don't have easy access to the system and they can easily use the data and visualizations, I see the effectiveness being limited.
So we will also produce reports. So like I said, derivative data can still be very powerful. You know, it has some interesting reporting features just on the very first page about, you know, number of registrations that we're counting, number of resolvable names that we're counting, percentage by new versus old registry. What we've not put in there, for example, that I'm going to talk to our folks about is IDNs, and you know there are going to be other things. So we will be reporting, and we'll be working with the community to figure out what kind of reports they want, but we'll always be limited by our licensing.
Fair enough. Alan?
In the ITHI project from metric number M2 on abuse, we are customers from the DAR project, and we are also going to publish aggregates. And we have some different perspective on that, on what to actually show. And I'm going to show some data on Tuesday afternoon, so if you're interested, I will encourage you to come and join the session. And one of the questions is what form of publication the community will be happy with us. What is the granularity of information? And there's a tussle between publishing a lot and naming and shaming versus publishing aggregate that are a two core. So we're trying to find a balance between the two.
Fair enough. Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? So let me ask a bit of a harder question. Is it so budget-wise, I just want to make sure that this is already budgeted for and is going well with the budget, correct?
Yes, it is both in the FY18 and FY19 budgets, and we anticipate continuing the sort of ongoing funding associated with the feeds as well as continued development over time.
So you don't need board support in that on that front. Okay, thank you very much. Ron?
Support is always welcome.
Yes. Just to refresh my memory, the intent is to also have the data set made available to the community?
Which data sets we're using? We're publishing which RBLs, et cetera. That's all part of the methodology, yes. So somebody could theoretically, and that is the idea, if they wanted, they could take this and rebuild it themselves.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments on this subject? Ron?
Just a comment. Delighted to see the update, and obviously we're very interested in the progress on this initiative, and look forward to continue to be engaged on it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, our intent is that once we get through this sort of review phase, is to have monthly reports of aggregate statistics that can then be used to actually provide both input into policy discussions. As I'm sure you've seen, there was a letter that was submitted to ICANN regarding concerns about the abuse of domains, use of domains, but also to provide information to the community about sort of how things are getting better or worse. And that's part of the ITHI project to enable us to identify when a policy change has caused things to improve or worsen over time. And that our intent is to keep that data on a long-term basis to provide a time series showing how things are getting better or worse. Ram?
Just curiosity, have you received any pushback on using spam as an indicator?
A little bit, yes, but not massively. And it's really interesting because you do get this, well, you know, why spam? But when you talk on an operational level with registries, they're actually interested in that themselves as well. And, of course, we can just pull that out of the data, so you can split it. And it's actually very interesting because you do see when you start looking at the data, and hopefully we can produce reports on this, that there are most registries that have a lot of spam have all the other underlying issues, but not all. So, you know, I always say data doesn't give you answers, it gives you questions. So I sit for hours just looking at this and banging my head against the screen trying to figure out what's going on. So I think this is a really good tool for us, but also for the community as we try and figure out what we can learn from this and feed it back into the policy. But yeah, there has been some pushback.
Yeah, Kaveh, I think for the board discussion, and I've had some people come up to me and say, spam is content. and why is ICANN, you know, getting its head in that area? And we ought to have, I think, a fairly good response, talking point and response on that, because I believe, like John does, that it's a really good indicator, and we can't be ignoring it solely on principle. But I think we ought to, as a board, have a proper talking point on that.
Fair enough, and I would ask Akito to please prepare a scorecard for the board on that. Thank you very much. George?
Yeah, it's a good point, Ram, but I would argue that spam is a proxy for malware. It's the carrier, and it's a very common carrier of malware.
Okay, and I have another question. Basically, you have the whole platform. You have data sources, so adding information about other sources of unique internet identifiers, including numbers and ASNs, I would say should be very simply possible. But have you thought about that? I know, in the framework of ITHI or...
Yes.
Yeah, Alan, do you want to talk a bit more about what we're doing in the ITHI?
Sure. So when we started the ITHI project, we had a discussion with our friends and colleagues in the IR community and through the NRO. What we agreed on is that the NRO will be leading the project for the number community and will be leading the project for the name community. So the NRO have assembled a team from the registrar services to define some metrics, and they have decided to focus only and solely on the accuracy of the data, of the number data in the WIS database, and not to look at any of the abuse metric. So now there is a gap in between what we have done and what they have done, and it's still up in the air as should this gap be filled, and who is in charge, who is responsible for filling that gap. We clearly have the tools to do that, but we don't necessarily have a mandate to do it.
And it's not just about IP addresses or routing data. There are lots of other data sets out there. The problem is recognizing which threats we're trying to measure and whether the data correlates to it. So I fully agree that the routing and the IP address information is very interesting, and we'll work with the RIRs on that. I mean, if they want to integrate it or they just want to copy what we did, that's fine. But there's lots of other data feeds out there. The only question is which one to pick in our copious free time to look at next.
Okay, I think that might be also like the scoping might be a bit of a discussion point for the org and for the board, because I think unique internet identifiers and number, I mean, routing may be different, but abuse of IP addresses and all of that, it can be helpful data, information for policymakers, especially with the history and all of that. So, and I know Alan is doing a lot in that area. I just wanted to point out that you have the platform, so it's a possibility. Okay. Any other questions or comments? If not, we will go to the AOB, basically, which is the only agenda item I have received for that, is the future of and format of this meeting. Is there any other AOB anyone wants to add? If not, we will jump into that. Okay. So to give you a bit of briefing, and there are two points I want to discuss here. One is the frequency of the BTC meetings, the whole package, because if you look at the BTC charter, we have three parts in the meeting. This part, the open part, is where we look into the future and possible developments in the technology and possibilities, the tools and information that's available. And we have other two. One is basically looking into the internals of the organization IT and projects that's being run, so tracking the projects. That's part of the board's fiduciary responsibility. And the other one is developments related to the work of ICANN constituencies and the technical requirements coming from that, including, for example, home court mail and issues like that, which we discuss normally in the second session of BTC, out of the three we have every time. So these three parts, as BTC was formally, basically formed only in Abu Dhabi, it's very young. And we had a meeting in Abu Dhabi. We had another meeting during the board workshop in LA, and now this is the third one formally. But looking at the level of material and the turn of issues, we think
maybe that's too much. There is a lot of pressure and there's a lot of work to prepare that stuff, and we don't have that much material to be productive. So the suggestion that we are going to make is basically to have three full, these are four-hour blocks, three of these per year, so before basically or during each ICANN meeting. So we have this here, next one would be in Panama, and next one in Barcelona. And not to have interims during the workshops or phone calls, except if there is an agenda topic that we have to discuss. Is there any VTC member who is against that or doesn't like that or has any objections to change this change of frequency? Obviously, we can also change back if we see this is too scarce or even if that's too much. But for now, we think that should fit the items that we have. Afri?
Thanks. Just to make sure I understand. So if there is an emergency or some such thing, we will then have... Okay.
Definitely. Yeah. And there are also some shared... for example, with BRC, we have a lot of things in common with the board risk committee. So for that, we might actually, like in the interim, next to the workshops, we might have a one-hour or 90-minute meetings together with other committees who have interest in the work of BTC. But they will be also on demand. Okay, so if there is no objection on that, we will do that. The second part is the format of this open part of the meeting and combination with TEG, which came basically from Octo. I really like the idea, but I will leave it to David to make the proposal.
Yeah, so the TEG was created primarily as a way in which the board could get exposed to technological developments within the context of the Internet identifier space. Back before the Board Technical Committee existed. Since the creation of the Board Technical Committee, it feels to me like there is some redundancy in the existence of, you know, particularly the public portion of the BTC meeting and the TEG. And I guess the question really is whether or not we need to continue the TEG in its current format or whether the public session of the BTC could be used as a way, you know, move it to the Wednesday slot, which is usually used for the TEG, and make that sort of the TEG equivalent moving forward. So that's the idea.
Yone?
I think that sounds like quite an interesting idea and something that worth pursuing. And that would change also the public part of this to be more inclusive than being on the Friday where not everybody's here yet, and would clear some of the overlap. And I think it would be time to... We have had the TEG now for, 4 years, I think? 3-4 years? It would be a good time to review that, and I think that this joining it together with this would be a good way forward. So I would certainly support that. Maybe we could ask if Octo could come up with a proposal of how to do that exactly, and then we could move forward with that maybe already in the next TEG meeting. I don't mean the one this time, but the one after.
Right, and the next one would be scheduled for Barcelona because we don't, at least historically, have not done the TEG meetings during the policy forum.
So there are two things. First of all, there will be another change if it mix with TEG, and that is this meeting, as I stated at the start, by design, but it was just based on some discussions, is open to observers, but normally they do not interact. For example, the chat room was closed now. But if we go to the TEG, it will be much more open, which I like, and I think that would be a very good opportunity for the board to basically have direct interaction with the experts instead of just allow them to observe. So I think that would be a positive thing, but please be aware of that, and if you have comments about that, please make sure that happens. And the other thing is, should we have three of these or two? Because the TEG normally doesn't have in a meeting B or the policy. Yone?
I think I would suggest that we can learn as we go forward with that. So let's, if we take the slots of the TEG for basis to start, and then if we need three, then we expand. But having a kind of like already existing cadence most probably is quite useful. here.
So we'll aim for two public meetings per year, basically.
Right. I think that we actually, now that I think about it a little bit, we might want to actually review that a little bit better, because it's maybe we don't want to be constrained with just kind of like with a TEG, but kind of like really look at what is the role of TEG going forward, but make this to be the kind of like public meeting where board interacts with the technical community within IETF meetings. And
within IETF?
Well, within ICANN. ICANN, IETF, I something. yeah, just carry on. Anyways, within ICANN meetings, and then see that how the TEG actually fits to that. But take now as a kind of like basis the TEG slot, and then see how many meetings we need per year to do this work.
Okay, so may I suggest that we discuss that in the Barcelona meeting and ask also TEG if they want three or whatever. Ram?
Kaveh, what does the board do with the sessions, you know, there's TEG meetings and there's sessions in there? What has the board done with it so far? I mean, it's received knowledge, perhaps, but has it actually... Is there something, is there an outcome from that?
No, I, to my knowledge, the whole idea of the TEG and also the two public sessions we had on the BTC has been mostly informational. So also the BTC ones, we didn't take any actions or action items. And this has been the interaction with the TEG. And I don't think there is any plan to change that, at least this is my understanding. But I think it should be more than open to change. First, David, then you.
Yeah, and one other point to note is that with, you know, OCTO's creation, which was after the TEG was created, and, you know, sort of the work that we've been doing, particularly in the context of, like, the Emerging Identifier Technologies session that Adiel leads and the ITHI sessions and other, you know, related sessions, we have been able, I hope, to provide a more direct focus on items of interest and information that had in previous incarnations had been done as TEG, you know, sessions within the TEG. So it may be that that particular aspect of the TEG has also been made somewhat redundant by the more specific sessions. So that's another item to consider in this discussion.
Yonid and up.
Yeah, so sorry, being a little tired, I tried to formulate this in somehow coherently, but so my feeling about this is that I've had similar questions in mind what Ram has about the role of TEG. I think that how I now kind of like structure this in my head is that the formal way of getting technical input into the board's deliberation is the BTC. And therefore, what I think that what we should do with the BTC is open it up to kind of like that it's not just talking hands among ourselves and other people listening, but it becomes more interactive and it becomes the kind of like technically outreaching part of the board towards the community, diverse parts of the community. In addition to that, I think that we should review the role of TEG in that space. What it should or what could be its role going forward, taking into account that the main vehicle of getting technical input to the board through this is the BTC. And so I think that we should review the role of TEG, see what it has accomplished and what it could accomplish. But as a kind of like a first step is to move this into their slot and take them into this discussion, but as a parallel also review their role in the grander scheme of things. I don't know if that was very coherent or made sense, but that's no, at least how
was,
I think it.
It was, and I agree. Thank you very much. Afri?
Thanks. I might have gotten myself a little confused during this. Is it my understanding that, therefore, if you're mapping the BTC meetings to the TEG meetings, that you would not have a BTC meeting during the policy forum, or you still would, and that meeting would be dedicated almost to looking at BTC in light of policy as opposed to in light of technical development?
So BTC meetings have three parts. So we will have the first two parts during all ICANN meetings, so three times per year. The third part we will have two times, so at least for now. And we said we don't take actions here, but based on the discussion, I think a good action item is to basically ask OCTO to write up their suggestion for this change, and we will discuss it in BTC, I guess, during Panama. And we will make a final announcement decision, make it public, and in Barcelona we will have the first public meeting. If during the Barcelona, I will make sure that that is an agenda item to discuss with the whole with the whole room, whoever is in that room, TEG and BTC and others, to decide how to move forward. That should be, I think, a consensus decision of all participants. So we will do that. Yes, and we are almost done with time. Ram, do you have any point? Okay. If there are no other points, I would like to close the session. And thank you. Thank you very much for participating. And thanks to all the observers.
Cheers.
Thank you.